Bangladesh and Houston, Texas, are separated by thousands of miles. And in some ways, they are worlds apart. But here is one thing that unites both those places. They each show us why having a union really is the only way to make sure that any worker is safe from exploitation, wage theft, harassment, and actually death. Because today we journey to both those places to take a look at workers' struggles to control the free market machine. This is Jonathan Tessini, and this is the Working Life Podcast for March 13th, 2019. And as usual, we start off with a reminder that the podcast is brought to you in part by our major sponsor, the Amalgamated Transit Union, the largest transit union in North America that fights for the interests of its 199,000 hardworking members and promotes mass transit. It's also sponsored by the National Union of Healthcare Workers, a member-led movement for democracy, quality patient care, and a stronger voice in the workplace. And you can hear the podcast in so many venues like the Progressive Radio Network, Thursdays at 6 p.m., and Spotify and iTunes. It's everywhere. We depend not just on our big financial supporters, but many small financial supporters, like many of the listeners of the show. So please go over to workinglife.org and click on the podcast tab. Look for our link to Patreon so you can become a financial sponsor of the show at whatever level you can afford. I want to start off with a very quick update on a story from last week's episode. You may remember that I spoke last week with Scott Slauson, the president of Local 506 of the United Electrical Workers, who talked to us about the strike by almost 2,000 members of his local and a sister local in Erie, Pennsylvania, who had begun a walkout on February 26th against a company called Wabtec. The workers at that plant have made locomotives for 100 years, making a fair wage, about $35 an hour, which, with health benefits and a fair pension, means that people could actually pay their bills. The company was taking a hardline union-busting posture after buying the plant from General Electric, and it was refusing to even extend the labor agreement for just 30 days, and it was trying to cut the wages drastically, including up to 38% cuts for new hires and recalled workers, and the company was also trying to impose an awful two-tier wage system where new workers are hired at lower wages than people that are already on the job. Well, the day the podcast aired, the two sides reached a deal to end the strike for 90 days and continue negotiations for a long-term collective bargaining agreement with the assistance of federal mediators at the table. And that deal would maintain, apparently, wage rates and benefits for existing workers, though there wasn't any promise yet to try to not impose that awful two-tier system or use outside contractors for work over the long term. Now, I'm not saying it was the podcast that brought that deal about, but I'm not saying it wasn't the podcast either. Anyway, just kidding. It's great to see that the worker strike brought at least a temporary truce, and it looks like at least some of the awful provisions the company was trying to impose are off the table, but we'll see how those negotiations go over the next 90 days. If you're looking for a place to see the scourge of free market capitalism at work, you don't have to look further than Bangladesh. Thousands of workers have died or been injured working in slave labor-like conditions. Dirt poor wages, life-threatening safety and health dangers, and harassment by companies and the government. Now, regular listeners here, and actually mostly readers of my blog, know the words Rana Plaza and Tazreen Fashions. I wrote a lot on the blog, which you can find actually at the same Working Life website as the podcast, about the 2012 fire at Tazreen and the 2013 collapse of the Rana Plaza factory, which stand as symbols to the greed and avarice of garment industry employers. Over 1,100 souls were killed at Rana Plaza, with many others injured, and the fire at Tazreen took the lives of 100+ people and scarred so many more. Not to mention the devastation to thousands of families who lost loved ones and also lost an income source that often meant the difference between being able to eat and starving. After those horrendous incidents, a smidgen of improvement began, largely because of international pressure on the garment brands. Many of them were pressured essentially to sign on to what is known as the Accord on Fire and Building Safety in Bangladesh, which is an independent, legally binding agreement between those garment brands and trade unions to work towards a safe and healthy garment and textile industry in Bangladesh, covering factories that were actually producing what they call ready-made garments, meaning RMGs, as well as home textiles and fabric and knit accessories. That deal covered hundreds of primarily European retail brands at more than 1,000 factories, and it did a lot to educate workers on safety and other workplace rights. But now it appears the government is seeking to expel the accord and is backsliding big time on the very, very tiny movements made on workers' rights that would allow people to try to join a union without harassment. Just recently, over 11,000 workers have been fired in the wake of strikes to protest low wages, and many of them had been seeking to form unions, and those folks were attacked and beaten. And the intensity of the attacks was especially targeting women. To talk more about this, it's good to have back on the show Monica Hartzell, a program officer at the Solidarity Center and an expert on workers' rights in Bangladesh. And Monica, before we get into this really important issue, I'm always curious about how people like you get into this kind of work, become committed to international solidarity and workers' rights generally. So what brought you into this work?
So I have always been passionate about community organizing and thinking about how to stand in solidarity with workers all around the world. I think my first foray into this was while I was working for an NGO in Cambodia. And I could see at that time there were massive protests going on in the garment sector. So I would see a lot of workers, many of them looking really young, a lot of women workers parading down the street to call for better wages and working conditions. And I remember being so inspired with their bravery, because you knew in a way that they were marching toward a really uncertain situation and putting themselves at great risk to stand together with their brothers and sisters and say that, you know, we've had enough and we deserve more as workers. And I think that seeing those kinds of examples made me think about my own life. How can I stand in solidarity not only with people in my own community who are struggling for dignity on the job, but also for my brothers and sisters all around the world?
One of the things that struck me as we go into this topic is that we've talked about Bangladesh on this podcast a number of times, going all the way back actually to the Accord discussions in the wake of the fires, the horrible fires that struck the workers in Bangladesh. As you well know, 1,200 garment workers died both in the fire at Tazreen Fashions and then the Rana Plaza collapse, which I wrote about on my blog back in 2013. And I thought what struck me in this conversation was that there had been some progress in Bangladesh. In the wake of the fire, there was a lot more international pressure, certainly from unions. There was the accord that was signed, and it seemed like things were getting slightly better, understanding the context of Bangladesh. But this seems like now a step back, where all of a sudden you've got thousands of workers being fired in the wake of these strikes that you all at the Solidarity Center have been talking about, the strikes in December and January, and then the gender-based violence. So talk about that in the macro sense. Do you sense that there's a backsliding and things are getting worse now?
Absolutely. There has been tremendous progress since, you know, the tragedies that were preventable at Tazreen Fashions and Rana Plaza that killed so many workers has really forced open space finally for unions to have the ability to come together to organize and to bargain collectively with employers. We've seen since Rana Plaza about 500 new unions that were registered. So of course there's certainly progress. Certainly the accord has helped workers to make tremendous gains in remediating horribly unsafe factory conditions. But what we're seeing right now with this massive crackdown on worker rights is a clear escalation in what's been, you know, what's been a continued struggle for workers to be able to freely assemble and to organize in an increasingly repressive environment. So I guess perhaps I can just kind of paint you a picture of the scale of this crackdown and how it's clear that workers who are organizing are being very specifically targeted.
Yeah, please do. So, please go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, what we've seen since December 9th when the protests for a fair minimum wage began is very intense and kind of brutal put down of these mainly peaceful protests by police and by employers and their hired thugs. So, you know, there were situations where there were gangs of 50 men hired ostensibly by management pursuing workers who were in the street demonstrating for a fair minimum wage and attacking them with metal rods. There were situations where police were entering into factories where workers were staging a walkout and actually throwing tear gas shells inside the factory. In one really egregious example, there was a large factory that actually had a daycare center on the ground floor, and police charged at workers inside the factory, and there were actually 14 children who were injured in that scuffle. Later, management sent around a list of all the mothers who had children in the daycare and fired them so that they could close down the daycare. So these are just a few of the the examples, and there are many more that we have heard directly from workers about how repressive this situation was. And not only that, in the aftermath of this initial crackdown in December and in January, now we're seeing numbers of Industrial is reporting numbers of up to 12,000 workers who were fired in retaliation for these protests. And we're seeing thousands of workers who have been charged, trumped up criminal charges related to vandalism and looting that are completely erroneous. You know, you'll have an example, for example, of a worker who is charged of vandalism in a factory, you know, a couple of miles down the road that worker has never been to in his or her life. So, you know, all these kinds of really these forms of judicial harassment. We also know that over 100 workers were arrested, and there's still 11 workers who are in jail after more than a month. So this is the scale, and we haven't seen this scale of crackdown in many years. Hmm.
And it's gotten to the point where Bangladesh is now considered among the world's 10 worst countries for workers' rights based on this ranking from the International Trade Union Confederation in 2018. And so one of the things that I had said is that there seems to be a regression in Bangladesh's standing in terms of workers' rights. And when you were talking about these thugs who were entering in with these iron poles or rods and beating up people, it reminded me of the back in the early part of the 20th century when Pinkertons used to go into union organizing areas where there were sit-down strikes. They used to actually kill people, but they used to certainly beat them up. And what changed that were unions. And so I'm curious, who is motivating this? Is this the employers pushing the government, or is the government really behind this? What's your sense of the dynamic?
You know, I think that on both sides, there is both a lack of will to change the status quo and a lack of capacity to do so. So, I mean, we've seen that the government of Bangladesh has been admonished in the public sphere by the International Labor Organization and international campaigning groups for a long time about its insufficient labor laws and its insufficient implementation of those laws to protect workers. And despite all of that, despite the U.S. government revoking generalized system of preferences, trade privileges, we really haven't seen the government make serious efforts to improve conditions. And on the other side, you have the employers who, many of them are extremely politically connected. We have, many members of parliament who own garment factories themselves or whose family members own garment factories. So there's very little incentive for them to, spend money on improving standards. They're benefiting from a system that keeps wages low in the sector, that represses the voice of workers who are trying to improve things for themselves. So it's a situation where you also have a lack of understanding on the part of employers, or a lack of willingness to understand that unions actually help improve industrial relations. I mean, we have many examples of, during this period of unrest, of union leaders going to their employers and speaking calmly about the situation, bringing the concerns of their members to their employer about the wage scale. And we have these employers completely dismissing them and refusing to discuss the challenges that workers are having. And, so when you see that they're not interested in dialogue, they're not interested in improving conditions for workers, that, it could be a situation where a union could actually help employers to move forward in a more productive way that's beneficial for everyone. But we're not seeing them recognize that.
And to the point where, as you are reporting, the Solidarity Center's reporting, that it looks like the government is on the verge of expelling the Accord on Fire and Building Safety in Bangladesh, which was an important accord in terms of at least trying to address the safety issues. Is that what's happening?
Yes, the accord has been facing continued judicial harassment by the highest court in Bangladesh is set to rule. I believe the new date is in April. It's been postponed multiple times, but the goal is to remove the accord's physical presence in Bangladesh, which would really hamstring its ability to effectively investigate the safety conditions in factory and to ensure that those problems are remediated. So right now we've seen that the government of Bangladesh has made a series of 8 very specific demands on things that the accord would have to change in its practices in order to remain in country, which of course they can't agree to. It would completely hamstring their ability to be effective in any real way. One of the things that's really important about the accord, even though it does focus specifically on fire and building safety, the accord has really helped to open up space in those factories that are supplying to accord brands for workers to feel more confident in their ability to organize and to bargain collectively, because they know that they have a recourse to brands that can leverage their power to put pressure on employers who are trying to derail their organizing campaigns.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, the last topic that I want to address with you, and this is one of the things that we wanted to really dig into, and it is tied to essentially, we just celebrated, recognized International Women's Day. And everything we just talked about Bangladesh workers being targeted, it's even more intense and even more dangerous for women. And that there's really in a sense that these employer-directed assaults are very much gender-based. So talk a little bit about what that means and how that's happening.
Yes. You know, garment workers have long experienced harassment and gender-based violence on the job. You know, this is nothing new. You know, employers asking for sexual favors to improve their wages or to get a promotion. These things are really endemic in this industry and in many industries. But what we're seeing now is that we're seeing employers increasingly using gender-based violence as this tool to silence workers who are organizing. Because women workers are the backbone of the garment industry, and they're also the ones who are really driving the labor movement. So you have a lot of both factory-level unions and national federations who are led by really dynamic and powerful women leaders. And, you know, that is something that challenges the basic business model of the global garment sector, because they really benefit from being able to use these discriminatory gender norms that devalue women's work to pay them lower wages and to cut corners on health and building safety and all these kinds of things. So, you know, what they're doing is targeting those women who are standing up for their rights. And we've seen, we've heard a lot of really troubling stories from workers. You know, we'll see thugs kind of pulling off women's headscarves, which is a really degrading action culturally, to explicit threats of rape, that, you know, if you continue to not fall in line to raise your voices collectively, you will be punished, and you will be punished in a way that uses this kind of fear and shame to make women really afraid to organize. And it's kind of this very insidious way of reinforcing these power structures that keep women down and also keep workers down.
And so what's the ultimate solution now from your point of view as we move forward?
So there are a number of very clear demands that we're hearing from workers who are united through the Industrial Bangladesh Council. They're asking the government to withdraw false criminal charges against workers, to make sure that the workers who are currently in prison are freed, and to reinstate those workers who have been fired unfairly and unlawfully. And in general, to stop this culture of harassment and retaliation against workers who are exercising their rights to free assembly and to freedom of association and to collective bargaining.
Now, to be sure, thousands of people are not dying in Houston in the same fashion as workers in Bangladesh, but robbery happens just the same. And it's the robbery of wage theft. And that's not theft that happens at the point of a gun. Nah, companies are more crafty and deceptive in how they pull this off. And wage theft is a cancer. Just about 2 years ago in episode 32, and you can check that out in the archive as you can listen to all our past episodes in our archive. In episode 32, I took a deep look at wage theft, which takes billions of dollars every year out of the pockets of workers. Let me say that again. billions of dollars. Wage theft can be as simple as not paying someone money for overtime, and a worker either not knowing that she or he was ripped off, or she or he is simply too afraid to protest because doing so on your own without a union having your back is a scary thing. Or it can even be more subtle than that. The boss can say, hey, why don't you, before you clock in, just start working a half hour early or stay an hour later? But of course, you don't get paid for that extra time that you worked off the clock, and that is wage theft. And now we have some new data on what is up in Houston on wage theft, thanks to the Faith and Justice Worker Center. And here to talk about this breaking news is Marianela Acuña Arriaza, the executive director of the organization. Marianela was last on the show at the end of 2017 to talk about the threat to the health of day laborers who were cleaning up after Hurricane Harvey. And you can hear that conversation with Marianela in episode 59. And as you quite well know, Marianela, one of the things about wage theft, it's a very hidden issue in the sense of we're used to hearing about union busting. We're used to hearing about some more explicit ways in which workers are being robbed, the wages are too low. But this wage theft kind of slips under the radar screen a little bit. And I think partly that's because of the lack of enforcement. So tell me a little bit, let's talk about the general issue of wage theft, and then let's get into the specifics of what you found.
Yeah, so wage theft, it's tricky because you really have to be looking for it in some instances, and then in some instances, it's very blatant and easy to see. So employers are very creative in terms of how they steal wages from people. We have cases where, a group of workers will finish a project, whether it's like painting a house or finishing a fence around a home or a business, and then they won't get paid at all. And that's, in your face, we know about it. And it's like easier to take action against it or to solve that. But then there's, of course, all these like smaller instances where people are stealing, or employers are stealing, the break time, the tips, they start 30 minutes early every day and close 30 minutes late, and that's an hour of work that they're not paying over a year, so they're not paying minimum wage, or overtime, and so there's like many ways that wage theft happens, and it happens in all industries. It definitely happens across the city of Houston. And you have to look into your paycheck to see really if the money that you're getting from your employer is adding up to the hours that you worked and the agreed pay that you have.
Now, you highlighted a couple of things about the way workers find out about this wage theft, and it underscores in some way the problem. Number one, I assume that almost all this wage theft happens in the absence of a union, because unions obviously are very, very careful about making sure their members are not being ripped off. And the worker has a recourse. If they think there's a problem, they can go to their union. The union can file a grievance. And related to that, it requires that when a worker on their own sees some sort of wage theft, that they have enough, if you will, courage or the way to stand up to their employer, because they fear that someone might fire them. So in order to challenge that, if you don't have a union, you have to have enough courage to stand up for yourself.
Absolutely. So in terms of the cases that we get that are non-union workers, is most of them, if not all of them, virtually. And it completely relates to people fearing retaliation from their employer, that if they say something about not getting paid some of the overtime or some of the break time, or let's say like transportation or on call, time that they are not getting paid, that they will get fired or get demoted. And they don't want to see that. And of course, there's even other vulnerabilities that workers may have, which are related to like immigration status or sexual harassment in the workplace. And so these cases get really complicated really fast, because it's definitely about wage theft and, you know, just wage and hour like violations, but it's all these other layers of like the power dynamics that you have in a workplace. And of course, unions are such important, you know, entities to protect workers, that whenever employees don't have that at their workplace, it's much harder for them to come out and speak out and talk about what's happening. And the information that we have gathered in the last year has been so effective because people were asking people to call us whether they're doing something against their employer or not. But at least for us to know what's happening in the city of Houston, because if you are not talking about it because you're so scared to talk about it, then no one knows. It will be much harder to identify it as a systematic problem. And what we're doing is encouraging people to call us whether they're wanting to do something against their employer or not, to report it for us to know what's going on.
Mm. And you mentioned a couple of other factors that contribute to workers being vulnerable. One is their immigration status. And then one, you mentioned sexual harassment. So did you find that women are more vulnerable and are more victims of wage theft than men? Is there a gender difference here?
We have actually a lot of the folks that call us are men. And I think that's related to the kind of outreach that we do, where we usually we talk to domestic workers and we talk to restaurant workers, but I think most of the outreach time that we do is at the corners where day laborers come. And so I think it's more related to that than actually an ability to say that it happens mostly to men. I think it happens to women a lot too. But what we have seen is that in specific cases where there is wage theft, there is usually another kind of threat that's happening to the worker. Other than, you know, we'll fire you, then you have like ICE threats, so you have like sexual harassment threats, or sexual harassment happened first, and then one of the retaliation tactics that the employer will use is wage theft. And so wage theft is kind of like weaponized against workers for speaking out, you know?
And this wage theft overall, and we did a segment on this podcast some months ago with the Economic Policy Institute, and you refer to the EPI's report looking at wage theft. It's in the billions of dollars on an annual basis, because if you think about throughout every city and every state all across the country, and unfortunately because there's a lot less unionization around the country, this wage theft, I think, is becoming it's really a plague, and it happens in every community because it's so easy for employers to do things. Like you cited one aspect of a wage theft. It's not just simply taking money out of your paycheck. It's telling you, oh, sign in a half an hour earlier and then sign out half an hour later. And that's a full hour that someone's not getting paid for if all they're being paid
every
for.
Every day.
Yeah, every single day. And there, you know, that's kind of on the margins, but it adds up. And what made me refer to this is, as I understand from reading the information you've put out tentatively, and I want to emphasize to my listeners that a full report from the FJWC is coming out May 1st, and I'm certainly happy to have another segment when you put out the full report and your full data. I assume that what you're reporting here, $1.2 million, has to be just the tip of the iceberg in a city like Houston, because you're relying here on people picking up the phone and proactively calling you. Am I right about that?
Yes. So the $1.2 million that we recorded in stolen wages during 2018 were fully self-reported. So these are the people who are willing to volunteer that information to us and call our line. And so it's not a statistically significant. We definitely think that it's very conservative estimate of like what's happening in the city of Houston. This is just the people who were brave enough to call us and that knew about us and found us and looked for us to find us. Or, you know, we met them doing the outreach work that we do. But it's definitely a limited amount of people who we were able to reach. And at the same time, we were very interested in that, even though it's not statistically significant, you know, like survey or anything like that. It was so aligned with the Economic Policy Institute's findings. You know, the average amount of money, it was only like $300 a difference in terms of like the amount of wage theft, and then also like the proportion of people's like annual income that gets stolen was also similar. And so we were interested that even though it's a completely self-reported, call us and we'll you know introduce into this database. It still was very aligned to those findings. Mm.
And how many people roughly did self-reported?
So we got about, for wage theft specifically,
yes.
We got about, I think, 356 calls or something like that, right under 360 claims. Mm.
Well, I'm just going to say without, just off the top of my head, that my point before that this has to be the tip of the iceberg when you think of a city the size of Houston. I mean, literally, we must be talking about tens and tens of millions of dollars.
Millions of dollars.
That are being stolen and from people.
Yeah. And the other thing that happens is that people call us and they have a claim and we report that claim. But usually, since we don't only document cases, but we also actually take and manage and solve cases with people, we have the sense that most people underreport their amount of wages stolen at the beginning because they will come, for example, you know, they fired me and it was unfair and they didn't pay me the last 2 weeks of work, right? And so we'll calculate and they'll tell us like, this is how much they owed me. And then whenever we start counting that they didn't get paid over time or that they weren't paid for like short breaks, or for transportation time between like, you know, one place and the other. So we start seeing that their wage theft is actually a lot more than they initially thought. So usually not, I don't have like data on this, but usually the amount of money that at the end the claim has is a lot bigger than what people initially thought it was. Because there's, at least in Texas, there's not enough I mean, there's a lot of misinformation, but there's also not enough information about what your rights are in terms of like, how do you really, what is the time that you're entitled to get paid for? And then what's minimum wage and how do you calculate like, you know, your overtime? That's something that we don't learn in high school or college, right? Like you just learn when these things happen to you. And then you have to be like, oh my God, like they stole all this money from me. And I didn't know. Right.
So I mentioned before in the beginning of our conversation that one of the main reasons that wage theft happens is obviously the low rate of unionization, just that unions are weak and you can't find them. And certainly Houston, unfortunately, is a good example of that. But the second part of that is that there's a lack of enforcement, and in a certain way, both the decline of unionization and the lack of enforcement is the exact space that worker centers like yours fills and is needed, because if you don't have a union protecting you and the government doesn't have the resources either explicitly because it doesn't care or it decides that it's going to underfund a specific area of enforcement, for example, wage and hour laws, then this is the space in which the employers take advantage of people, because the message is, well, there's not a union and the people, the prosecutors, the Department of Labor, the local Department of Labor doesn't care, doesn't have the resources. That's why it happens, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think employers steal wages from workers because they think or know that they can get away with it, right? And so both like unions and government agencies are usually the people that hold it down. But with government agencies, it's complicated because it's so centralized, right? So we have for example, in Texas, we have our Texas Workforce Commission. We work closely with them to solve cases. We have the Department of Labor who, like the Wage and Hour Division also helps us. We have good relationships with their locals here in Houston. But it's not enough. There's like so much trust to build with community, which I think sometimes we have closer than the government agencies. But then also there's like so much work to do. I don't remember the numbers right now, but there was this really, really interesting report that Gus Bova, reporter, I believe with the Texas Tribune, you know, that he was analyzing all the cases that come to the Texas Workforce Commission and how few of them are actually solved, because they're fully like understaffed and under-resourced. The union density, you know, if we had unions at every workplace, then that resolution of issues like this would be fully decentralized, and kind of like each team of people that works in a workplace could like solve these things, but we don't have that infrastructure in the state of Texas. And it has been like very intentional, like policy making against like unions and against like people's ability to organize, right? And to bargain together.
Mm. And so as we wrap up with my last question, one of the things that you emphasize is that most people that are affected by this wage theft tend to work in low-paying industries. And that's partly the issue that we talked about before, immigration status and other reasons. And so we know for a fact that even if you get paid properly, your minimum wage, the minimum wage is a starvation wage, a poverty level wage. And yet on top of that, what you're finding with this wage theft is that the average victim in Texas loses 30% of their annual earnings. And so I want you to comment on this notion about the actual impact that wage theft has, so that people understand it's not just, oh, there's not a few dollars in the pocket to say, go out to a movie or spend wildly and do something fancy. It's really about being able to survive.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what we found in these cases is it's about a little bit under $3,600 that people on average are getting stolen. And if you divide that by 725, that's 494 hours of work, which is our minimum wage here. And that's 3 months of work. If I were missing $3,600, and I'm not a minimum wage worker, I couldn't like pay rent or food or, anything really, like car insurance, etc. Like it's unbelievable, like the impact that this has on families. And whenever we receive claims, either on the phone or whenever people come to visit us, you can definitely tell that this is not just like, oh, I'm missing some money. It's a full on crisis that people have been put in whenever they haven't gotten paid the amount of money that they're owed. I think, of course, each individual wage theft is a bit different. You know, if people are owed like over time, little by little, maybe the impact is not as big. I think whenever we calculate how much money they're owed and they see like, oh my God, I'm owed, you know, $5,000, they may not miss it as much. But especially whenever it's people who were working on projects or weren't paid in the, you know, domestic workers, restaurant workers that are made to work like two or three weeks without pay for like 12-hour days, et cetera, 12-hour days for like two or three weeks, and they just don't get paid and they're expecting that. It's impossible. It's like people getting evicted. It's, you know, kids like changing from school district to another because they were evicted and they couldn't make it. It's people not paying for insulin. And so it's really, really just horrendous, like the consequences that these like massive wage theft has on people.
Now Now it's time for our robber barons of the week, and they are the CEOs of Big Pharma. Now, I've pegged individual CEOs of Big Pharma before, but what made me award the crown of robber baron again this week to the whole crowd of the CEOs of Big Pharma was something I read recently. And it's from a study by two folks, William Lozanic and Onur Tulum, who were looking at the claim by Big Pharma that their huge profits, and remember, these are profits from charging people sky-high prices that some people just can't afford, and thus they can't buy them, and thus they die or they get sicker, that those huge profits were justified, this was the claim by Big Pharma, because they were taking the profits and putting the money back into research and development. That is pure rubbish. And now I'm quoting from a piece that Lozanic and Tulum wrote, quote, "We gathered data on the 500 highest paid executives in the United States from 2008 through 2017. The number who came from the drug industry ranged from 21 in 2008 and 2011 to 42 in 2014. The total compensation of those 42 executives averaged about $73 million, compared with an average of an already over the top $32 million for all 500 in 2014. And now this is Ticini saying, I just want to underscore what that means is that the Big Pharma executives, those 42 executives, were being paid twice as much on average as the already greedy average CEO who was being paid $32 million. The Big Pharma folks were being paid an average of $73 million. And now let me pick up the rest of the quote. A total of 88% of the 2014 compensation was based on stock. And this is Ticini again. You'll remember, my good listeners, I always remind us that the big money that the CEOs get is not actually in their regular paycheck, even though their regular paycheck is more than any of us can dream getting every 2 weeks. The big money is in stock options and retirement benefits. That's where they make the huge riches. And now back to the quote. In 2017, 28 drug executives in the top 500 averaged more than $41 million in total compensation, with 83% stock-based. By jacking up product prices and distributing the increased profits to shareholders, executives lift stock prices and their take-home pay. And that's the end of the quote. That's where the money from drug ripoffs goes. It goes into the pockets of the CEOs of Big Pharma, and that's why the CEOs of Big Pharma are the robber barons of the week. That'll do it for this week's podcast. Thanks to my guests, Monica Hartzell and Marianella Acuna Ariaza. Our audio editor, as usual, is David Hebden. Thanks to our major sponsor, the Amalgamated Transit Union, and our other sponsor, the National Union of Healthcare Workers. Thank you also to all the small contributors who support this podcast. If you want to join them, go over to workinglife.org, click on the podcast tab, and look for that link to Patreon, and go over there and become one of our sponsors at whatever level you can afford. Thanks for listening. Look forward to having you back next week.